Hello, and you're on The Front Porch. I'm Scott Finn, Executive Director of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, and today we're going to talk about right to work and whether West Virginia will become the 26th right to work state. I'm joined, as always, by Rick Wilson of the American Friends Service Committee. Hey, Rick.
Hello. Hey, Scott.
And we have Lori Lynn with the Charleston Daily Mail editorial page. Hey, Lori.
Hi, Scott.
And I'm so excited because the two of you have each written an op-ed piece about right to work. You can find both of their op-ed pieces on the website of the Charleston Gazette Mail, which is our underwriter. That's at wvgazettemail.com. You can tell they're coming from two different sides of the story, and the Gazette Mail is great for giving you all sorts of perspective on complicated issues like right to work. So check it out at wvgazettemail.com. My understanding is right now is a non-right to work state. If a workplace votes to unionize, then most of the workers in that workplace are automatically enrolled in the union. Is that right, Rick? Am I getting that?
The eligible, if the majority vote to join a union, all eligible workers are in the union. If they want to get out of the union, they can have another election and decertify the union.
A couple caveats. They get the benefits of being in that union.
Right.
And they also can opt out of paying the amount of their dues that would go to political activities if they want to.
Right. That's a result of a federal court case. It's called a Beck objector status.
And Lori Lynn, if we pass right to work, as it looks like the legislature is going to do, what will happen then?
Then employees in any workplace will have the ability to opt out of paying any, of having anything deducted from their paycheck automatically that goes to the union.
So we have lots of arguments for and against, and we want to get to them right away. One of the claims of folks who support right to work is that it will create more jobs. Lori Lynn, you've looked at the literature and the research on this. What did you find?
Well, as far as how many jobs it would create, I mean, the attraction is that, you know, for some employers, when they're looking at what state to locate in, it is an attractive feature to be in a right-to-work state because you can be somewhat more assured that you will not be having to deal with a union. I mean, we can look at, you know, the U.S. auto industry. Pretty much every automobile plant that's been constructed in the past two decades has been put in a right-to-work state. That's something that did not escape the notice of the state of Michigan, which enacted right to work in 2013.
What did the academic studies say? We have a lot of anecdotal evidence on each side.
Well, it's really hard, and this is what I talked about in my column. There are a lot of differences between right-to-work states and non-right-to-work states that don't have anything to do with labor laws. A lot of the right-to-work states are in the South and in the Midwest. No state in the Northeast or on the West Coast, which are, you know, the expensive places to live, places where cost of living is high. No state there has a right-to-work state law. So if you're going to just flat out compare wages between the two sets of states, that's not terribly scientific. Of course, wages are lower in Alabama than they are in California. You can't blame that on their right-to-work law.
I mean, West Virginia has a fairly low cost of living, too, and it's not a right-to-work-for-less state. I like to refer to it as right-to-work-for-less, which I think is a little more accurate there.
And we were talking about the nomenclature and the words that we use here. Rick, in your column, you said right-to-work as a term is kind of Orwellian.
Yeah, George Orwell talked about how in our time, political speech and writing are largely the defense of the indefensible. The great image of queer language is insincerity. And so, like, you know, remember 1984, they had slogans like war is peace, freedom is slavery, ignorance is strength. There's all these euphemisms. And calling this law right to work is misleading because who could be against the right to work? It's, you know, just by the name of it, so it's a misleading name.
I would just say that it is equally Orwellian to call non-right-to-work states, as people, some people on the left do, free bargaining states. What are they talking about? Who is making the free bargain? The free bargain is between the union and the employer. The worker has nothing to do with a free bargain. So I take your point, Rick, about Orwellian language, but I think
I would call it
applies to both sides.
Industrial democracy more than free bargaining because members have to ratify a contract as well.
So WVU did a study on this right to work and or right to work for less and what it would mean for West Virginia that showed, Lori, that this, according to their study, would create, in their opinion, more jobs and a higher GDP.
Yes, more employment and a higher GDP. Again, this is a prediction. This, you can't say that this is written in stone, but that is what they predicted, and I think that is a bit of a problem for right-to-work opponents. You have this study from the WVU Bureau of Economic Analysis on WVU letterhead. That was quite a coup, I think, for the right-to-work side.
I mean, a lot of things that come out of can be associated with the university letterhead. And to quote conservative economist from Marshall, there are no facts about the future. It'd be interesting for other people to look at the same data sets and have access to that to really take a look. But there have been studies about, like, one in Kentucky that was done recently about the effect of right to work for less and several others. The results are pretty inconclusive. And all the way, by the way, if the roof on your house collapses, that would contribute to GDP, but it'd be a real downer. So
let's talk about wages. There is some indication, although it's not unanimous, that wages could be slightly lower in right-to-work states. You talk about this in your article as well, Lori.
Well, they are lower in right-to-work states. The point is you have to control for all the differences, and there are a lot of different ways that you do that. There's a lot of disagreement in the academic literature about how you control for the differences. Depending on how you do that, some studies have found a slightly lower wage in right-to-work states. Some studies find no effect. Some studies even find that it's slightly higher because you bring new firms in, you increase competition. So I don't think there really is a definitive answer to that question. What we know is not correct is what the AFL-CIO claims on their website, which is that wages are, you know, will go down $5,000. That's absurd. That's not controlling at all for the differences between the states. You absolutely have to do that.
Okay, well, here's the way it undermines labor standards in the long run, because look at the basics. People who are members of unions are more likely to have living wages, benefits, paid sick days, so you can take care of your kids when you get sick, vacations, pensions, things like that. And unions also help set sort of a standard of living that many other employers offer. So a lot of employers who offer a basic benefits package do so largely because of the gains of the fast. So there's a spillover effect. So generally where you have a strong labor movement, you have a fairly higher standard of living.
But, Rick, do you think unions are victims of their own success in that way? I mean, do you think, you know, I don't dispute at all that unions did a lot, you know, a long time ago to raise standards. These standards are largely enshrined in the law now. Do you think the success that they've had now kind of setting these benefits and standards in stone makes them less relevant today?
Well, I'm glad you mentioned the fact that, you know, that there are standards that were established, because another thing to think about when you weaken labor is the labor movement historically has struggled for things like abolition of child labor, overtime laws, basic protection. And again, if you weaken the strength of labor in that scene, you're probably going to have not only downward pressure on wages, but those policies will be easier to attack. And, you know, some of the people who are saying they want to get privatized things like Social Security and Medicare, they want to roll back the ability to have legal recourse if people get sued or killed on the job. A lot of these whole push for deregulation is to undo a lot of the previous gains of the labor movement, too, things that people take for granted. Again, there's a saying, these are the people who brought you the weekend.
Do you all agree?
But the weekend is not going away if we have right to work. I mean, that's kind of my point.
Lori's saying, what have you done for me lately?
I mean, the Mercedes plant in Alabama, which is a non-right-to-work state, has the highest wages and benefits in the entire U.S. auto industry. It's not as if these workplaces in right-to-work states that are not union are these, you know, kind of hellish dystopian places. Basic labor laws still apply. Do we have evidence that these workers are really getting such a raw deal or being mistreated?
Well, let's talk about safety then, because that's a really big issue here. What do we know about right to work and its effect on worker safety?
Well, you know, if you want to look at a case study, what happens when you weaken the power of labor, let's just look at Upper Big Branch. That was once a union mine. Massey Energy made a conscious effort, you know, from the 80s on to weaken the UMW, to do all these shell games with subsidiaries to fight it. They acquired Upper Big Branch, and, you know, they made all these promises. They had great corporate picnics, took people to Dollywood, and they voted to decertify the union. And without that voice, workers had less say and control over working under unsafe conditions. And it came to the point where, you know, Massey had what was documented as a culture of deviance, where they had the power to sort of get around a lot of rules and regulations, environmental, worker safety, and otherwise. So when you take away these basic worker protections, you know, we're heading toward Massey land. So is that where you want to live?
Massey land. I don't know. I mean, they did do nice concerts. You know,
I didn't know you were a Ted Nugent man there.
There is evidence that union mines have lower rates of injury and death than non-union mines. At least I've seen that study done.
Because you have the right not to work under unsafe conditions versus get the hell out of here if you don't like your job.
Now, that's just one industry, Lori. But what do you say to that?
Yeah, I mean, mining is one industry. I think when you look at just general health and safety overall, I mean, again, you're in a world where you have to control for a lot of different things. There are differences in how inherently dangerous different industries are. Those industries tend to be clustered, you know, regionally. And there is a lot of disagreement, particularly when it comes to injuries. When you're dealing with workplace deaths, there are really so few of those that, you know, very few accidents can really skew the data in any given year. So those are a lot harder to analyze. But when you look at injuries, you know, again, it's just there isn't any rock solid data, any rock solid study that shows, you know, 100% the effect on health and safety.
Hey, we'll be right back to the front porch in just a minute. But first, I want to tell you about another podcast at West Virginia Public Broadcasting that you've got to listen to if you haven't yet, Inside Appalachia. All the stories about the culture, the arts, the people, the history of the region that we all love. Hosted by Jessica Lilly, produced by Roxy Todd. You can listen to it, of course, on West Virginia Public Radio on Sundays at 7 a.m. and 6 p.m. But if you want to listen to it on your own time, then check it out on iTunes, on SoundCloud, and of course, as always, at wvpublic.org. Is it fair to say we all agree that politically what will happen is that passing right to work in West Virginia will weaken unions in West Virginia?
I think it will. It won't just weaken the unions. I think it'll undermine labor standards for a lot of people, including those who are not union members.
It will weaken the unions, and I think that's really the effect on workers is, I think, ancillary to the effect on unions and, more importantly, the effect on the politicians that unions support. And that's why you're going to hear those people yelling about it the loudest. You know, where does this money go that is extracted forcibly from people's paychecks? It goes largely to Democrats and to, you know, progressive causes. And so I think those are the people who stand really more than workers to lose from it.
Well, let's talk about extracted forcibly from workers' paychecks. Again, the way people join a union, it's really hard to form one. Companies can intimidate workers, illegally fire them, and usually get away with it because the legal recourse is weak. So again, to form a union, the majority of workers have to vote in an election recognized by the National Labor Relations Board. To do that, the union then bargains for all the employees who are eligible there, who receive the benefits of union membership, and they contribute to it. If they believe the union no longer serves their interest, they can petition for another election and decertify. So it's a basic democratic process. I mean, I don't like some of the laws the legislature passes, and I may not even like some they might do next year, but I can't say I'm not included in that. Like, I don't like the speed limits. I don't have to drive by it. I don't think it works that way. Also, again, union members do not have to pay for the union's political activity, but the union's obligated to represent them should they have a grievance.
Yeah, I want to tell you, hear a lot about the free rider issue, and I just, you know, that's a half-truth. It sounds really bad to say, oh, well, you know, we have to represent you whether you pay us or not. The reason they have to represent you is because they have negotiated for exclusive representation. There's nothing that says that they have to have that kind of a contract. And in fact, in other countries, you have workplaces that are represented by more than one union. So I could be a member of Union A, Rick could be a member of Union B.
We have that here too.
Well, right, you can, but they largely don't want that because they, in fact, would rather be representing everyone.
Well, Lori, do the flip side of this argument. So Rick is like, well, there is an election and you need to abide by the election whether you like it or not.
Well, the flip side is if I didn't vote for the union, I am still required to pay a private organization money that is automatically deducted from my paycheck. And I may not agree with a single position.
But progressives usually believe in protecting the rights of the minority against the majority. I mean, that's something you often hear. But in the case of unions, all of a sudden it's majoritarian rule. If the majority of people in my workplace say that I have to belong to this union and give money to it, whether I disagree with everything it believes in or not, your progressive values say I should still just suck it up. I don't have any rights to not have to pay the money into it.
Democracy is not quite the same as consensus, which is universal agreement. So again, you know, I like to opt out of a bunch of laws the legislature may pass or the Congress may pass, but that's not the way things roll.
I don't think the analogy to a legislature really works. I mean, we're talking about, again, a private organization. I don't see how that is the same as, you know, our democratic legislature.
To the free rider question, there's this hilarious story, I think, from Kentucky. I think it's Owensboro, but I'm not sure, where a local group, I think it was a local building trades group, asked to be, you know, in the Chamber of Commerce, local chamber, but they didn't want to pay dues. And the chamber got most upset and said, how could you possibly receive the benefits, you know, without actually contributing? And I'm like, in what measure you mete it out, it shall be meted unto you, to quote.
Ricky wrote in your op-ed a little bit about the history of right to work, and it's not always a very pretty history, is it?
I think the person who's often viewed as the father of the right to work movement was a Texas businessman named Vance Mews. And if you want to look it up, his grandson wrote a really interesting article in the February 1986 Texas Monthly, where he talks about learning about his grandfather's legacy. He was a bigot, an anti-Semite, the kind of person who called the New Deal the Jew Deal. And he opposed the new labor laws coming out of the New Deal probably for two reasons. One, you know, he used racism to weaken labor laws, and he used weak labor laws to protect the segregated system in the South. If you look again, the first right-to-work states were slave states, were Confederate states, and it's kind of spread from there, which is all about weakening the position of labor, using the sharecropper system after that, keeping unions low and weak. Here's some things that he had to say about forced unionism. This is Vance Mews. From now on, white women and white men will be forced into organizations with black African apes whom they will have to call brother or lose their jobs. I mean, that's the kind of thing that he pushed, and he gained traction. And again, there's a Dartmouth historian named Mark Dixon who's documented this. They gained support of a lot of big business organizations for it, and, you know, got some of this written into law with the Taft-Hartley Act in 47. And, you know, if you look at it, you know, racism and union busing go together like peas and carrots, which is why Dr. Martin Luther King had some interesting things to say about it.
But let me ask you a question. Do you then say that those racist tendencies are behind the current push in West Virginia for right to work?
I'm just saying, if you look at the history, it's rather unsavory.
I mean, again, to the racism point, I have to say, if you're going to accuse Bill Cole of being a racist and anti-Semite and a bigot, but
I was talking about Vance Mews.
The history of it, I think, you know, okay, the prevailing wage also has a racist history of, you know, being anti-blacks coming up to the Northeast with the Great Migration and taking white jobs. I certainly wouldn't now say, you know, if you support the prevailing wage, you're a racist. I just don't know how useful it is to bring that up again, unless you're claiming that the people who are supporting right to work now here in West Virginia are doing it out of a racial motivation, which I just think is a kind of a difficult case to make.
Right. I did not question the motives of people going after it in West Virginia. I just think this is the history of the movement, one reason why it gained a lot of traction in the states where it did. And it was more about systemic issues than about personal views.
No, and that's certainly true. I mean, the South is anti-union. And I think that's another thing that makes it very difficult to study the effect of right to work laws in the South, because the attitudes toward unions there are very different from the attitudes, you know, in the Northeast, for example.
Lori, we were talking about the realities of this. The legislature comes into session mid-January, and in West Virginia, the governor can veto a bill of the legislature, but if they have enough time in the session, they can override his veto with a simple majority vote. What do you expect to happen with right to work this year in the legislature?
Yeah, I have some questions for whoever set up the veto process here, because it's kind of silly that you can, I mean, you know, right now it works for me because it's a Republican legislature, but The fact that you can override it just with a simple majority vote, the same vote you took originally, it turns it into just a matter of timing. I think what happened last year, really the fact that the Republicans took over both houses of the legislature was a bit of a surprise, even to the Republicans. And so I don't think kind of all the dominoes were in place. I think they very much are this year. I've been hearing about it since, you know, the summer that we are going to push for this. Bill Cole has said he has 18 votes lined up in the Senate. He's going to do this. He does not strike me as the type of guy who, you know, is bluffing about something like that. I think they do have their ducks in a row. I think they're really determined to do it. And again, the key, as you mentioned, is doing it early enough that the governor, you know, Tomlin will, I think, probably veto it. But as long as this happens early enough, they'll have time to go back and just, you know, redo it, and then that will override the veto.
You know, we'll see. And again, you know, the fortune is a wheel, so sometimes you win by losing and sometimes you lose by winning. So it's let the games begin.
Yeah, no, and I think that's a good point. I think you'll see a lot of protests. There'll be a lot of, you know, people standing on the Capitol steps and shouting. And I think that that's almost more about getting out the vote for the fall, next fall.
Although there hasn't been evidence of it, as you say in your article, in Indiana or Michigan or Wisconsin. There was certainly a lot of anger over passing anti-union laws, but most of the people that did it are still in power in these three states.
Yeah, I mean, what I would say is you can if you lose your seat, you know, if you're a Republican and you lose your seat in 2016, it will almost certainly not be because you voted for right to work.
So the percent of West Virginia workers that are represented by a union is about 12% today. That's not 12% of West Virginians, folks.
No, far from it.
That's 12% of the people who are working, and only about half the people in the state are in the labor force at all. Like one out of every 20 people or so. Is it possible we'll pass this and it won't really have that much of an effect?
The biggest thing that influences where a company locates is still the quality of the workforce. Right to work is up there, but it still comes second to workforce quality, and that's unfortunately a metric that we do very poorly on, and you know, this will not change that.
I mean, you need a good infrastructure, you need a good education system, you need a good workforce training program, some of which may happen to be union apprenticeship programs. Those are the kind of, you need a quality of life that people actually want to be here.
Rick, what's your Bible verse for the week?
Which one would you like? So this is from the book of Ecclesiastes, chapter 4, 9 through 12. Two are better than one because they have good reward for their toil. I like that. For if they fall, one will lift up his fellow, but woe to him who is alone when he falls and has not another to lift him up.
You look so much like a preacher with your well-worn
Bible. Now, if I could do it in a hillbilly voice, you want me to do the hillbilly preacher voice? That would probably be... I can do it.
Save it for when you're on the Capitol steps in January.
I can rant like that. I have a thought, though, you know, that it kind of applies to, I think, the way I think about the struggle to come. And I mentioned earlier, I've been rereading the Bhagavad Gita, this religious story from India. And there's a part of it I think is relevant here, that Arjuna, the warrior, is about to have to go to battle, but he's not going to go to battle with enemies, but with his kinsmen, his friends, and teachers. And he loses heart, and he asks his charioteer, who's Krishna, who happens to be a manifestation of God, what to do. And Krishna said, you know, you have to follow your dharma or your path in life. He said, it's better to fail at your own dharma than to succeed at someone else's. So get in there, do your duty, do your best, and surrender. Don't be attached to the results of your actions. Leave that to God. So that's the way I'm looking at it. I don't particularly want to fight anybody over this. I have to follow my dharma. People have to do theirs. And I'm not attached to the results of the action, although I would like it to go a certain way.
I think that's a really healthy way of looking at life. You fight the fights you're supposed to fight, and you do what you believe is right in your heart, and then you don't worry about the outcome because you don't have control over that. You've been listening to The Front Porch. I'm Scott Finn, joined by Lori Lynn of the Charleston Daily Mail editorial page, Rick Wilson of the American Friends Service Committee. We would encourage you to please subscribe to us on iTunes, or you can listen to us on SoundCloud, or again, available as always on wvpublic.org. Thanks for listening.